Well, welcome to another episode of Ideas and Lives. We've done well over 30 episodes chronicling the arc of people's career and their ideas about the world today. And I'm delighted that we have a very articulate and thoughtful and interesting friend, someone with interesting career and compelling ideas. He's also a neighbor, and I've known him for probably 40 years or more. And his name is David Epstein, and he's with us today. Hi, David.
Hi, how are you?
Good to see you.
Thank you. So, I call myself David Epstein.
Oh, Epstein. I'm sorry.
No problem. Somebody said like Steinway piano. So I said, okay, we'll do it that way.
All right. Well, that's good. We had in an earlier interview, we had the PBS economics correspondent, Paul Solomon. And he told us that people would call him Solomon, and someone even called him Tuna. So anyway, so the Steinway of David Epstein is with us today. David, tell us a little bit about where you grew up, your parents, what it was like, and how you grew up.
Okay. Well, I was born in San Antonio, Texas on June 19th, 1935, and the last couple of years, my birthday has become a national holiday, not because of me, but it is now marks the emancipation date for the slaves. Although in Texas at the time, some people would direct racial comments at me because the fact that I coincided with the day that in Texas, African Americans observed as a holiday. The reason June 19th was a holiday for African Americans was that they were the last people to learn that the Emancipation Proclamation had been issued by President Lincoln. And he issued it January 1, 1863, I believe, and it didn't get to Texas to the end of the Civil War in 1865, when the federal troops arrived after the Confederate States were defeated. So that was the date of my birth. And I was born into a family of two persons who had immigrated from different parts of Eastern Europe and under different circumstances. My father, his home name when he was a child in Mariupol, Lithuania, his name was Yehuda or Yudi Epstein, and he was one of a large family of brothers and one sister. And he arrived in the United States at the age of 18 in 1922 in the first week of September. And last year was the 100th anniversary of his arrival. So I chartered a bus and took my family and other extended family members, met us there. We went to Ellis Island. And I have the documentation of his arrival to celebrate his arrival in the United States. He was very grateful for being in the United States, very devoted to the type of life that the United States offered. My mother immigrated from Poland to Mexico. I didn't realize it at the time, but it sort of gave me an exotic background because the reason her family had come to Mexico was that they decided to immigrate in the late 20s, before the Holocaust, but the United States closed the borders in 1924. So my father was 2 years before, and my mother's family was a few years late. And in point of fact, my mother's parents, Abraham and Dora Furman, were married in New York City in 1901, but they returned to Europe because they were lonely for their family. But by the time after World War I, Poland was created as a separate independent nation state, as it had not been for 127 years. And the economic and, I guess, political situation, and particularly for Jews, was difficult. So family started migrating out of Mexico. And my father actually met my mother in Mexico City, where he was actually supposed to meet another young woman, but my mother opened the door, and by the time the other young woman arrived, 15, 20 minutes later, my father was already smitten by my mother, the woman who became my mother, and that's how
So
I ended
did
up.
did your father go there in order to make a match, or
Exactly.
he went all the way from New York?
No, we never were. He never lived in New York. I left this out. He moved immediately.
How did he get from New York to San Antonio?
Well, probably by train, but or bus. But he went to San Antonio because he already had three brothers living there. And the reason he had brothers living there, San Antonio was not a destination for many Jewish immigrants. And there was something called the Galveston Project, but that had been earlier, where Jews who were immigrating to the United States were encouraged to go to Galveston and spread out over other parts of the United States, because the Lower East Side of Manhattan was the most densely populated piece of property in the world. But my father had came to Texas, not because of what was called the Galveston Project, which was before he came, but because he had three brothers living there. And the reason the brothers were living there was the oldest brother had immigrated to Chicago, where people from my father's family, from my father's town or village, shtetl, moved, and you know, relatives bring other relatives and so forth. But my uncle Harry married a woman whose father was diagnosed with asthma, and the doctor said to him, "You need a hot, dry climate," and that's why the father-in-law moves to Texas, and the daughter, my aunt by marriage to my uncle Harry, says, "Let's go to Texas. We haven't got that much going for us in Chicago." So that set up all of the Epsteins ending up in San Antonio. And my father was there from the age of 18 to 27. I mean, he lived his whole life there afterward. But in 27, his sister-in-law says, you need a bride. And she gave him the name of her sister, but the sister wasn't the one that my father met at the door in Mexico City. So that's how. So I like to tell I told to the extended family that if the doctor in Chicago had an inhaler for the asthma, I wouldn't exist. But it never happened that way, because inhalers weren't invented till much later.
Yeah.
So that's how I.
Well, I
use
one on occasion, but. Anyway, so you were born in 35 there in San Antonio. Did your parents have a business, or was there an Epstein business of any kind? Or
yes, they
how
did
they make a living?
Well, my father, when he came, first started out as a peddler. He had a horse and carriage and a buggy, and not a buggy even, I think it was a cart, a wagon, and he would go from house to house and sell sweaters and other items that people needed. You didn't have their shopping malls, and people didn't have credit. So he would sell it to them on credit and collect each week. And each week when he went back to sell, he would try to sell them something else that he had. And then eventually with his brother, they started at a very small scale in buying real estate, very, very modest houses. And eventually they opened up a lumber company and were building houses for customers on credit for people who generally could not get credit in the banks. They weren't credit worthy by the bank's definition, but if you were patient, they would end up paying. So he grew that into a business. And that's what was the basis of his economic success. And his
did you work in that business at all?
I did. I would, I don't know, work. I mean, I was there. I would hang around. My father would take me to visit building sites, or to collect from customers, or to go to vendors who were supplying windows or doors or whatever. So, yes.
But you didn't become a construction worker.
No, I didn't. No. No.
All right. So now you're born there. You're growing up. You're in grade school and high school. Tell us. What were some of the highlights of your early schooling?
Well, My mother was had standards, is one of my cousins said after my mother passed away. And we understood that we had to do well and work hard and study and so forth. So each of us was a good student. And I guess one of my highlights was that in when I was in high school, I participated in a couple of citywide or countrywide contests. One was an oratory contest on the U.S. Constitution, and the other was a and I did well on that. And the other was a history contest sponsored by the Hearst newspaper chain, and I ended up third in the nation on that one. So I felt pretty good. History has always been a strong interest of mine, and has had an impact on my life over the decades. So those are two.
See that with your Juneteenth explanation. Right. So those were a couple of highlights, and then so you're doing well in school. You do this national contest. Did that help you get into college? And what motivated you to apply to colleges, and which colleges?
Well, I had a brother who passed away a few years ago, and he was. He went to college, started college at 16. He went to Tulane for undergraduate and medical school, and he skipped a couple of grades. He was a very good student. And so when I applied for college, going to college was definitely important, but it wasn't the same sort of, your life depends on which college you get into. But I got into Tulane, I got into Northwestern, and I got into Harvard, but Harvard wasn't the national brand at the time, as it later became. President Kennedy, probably, who was later, this was, I'm talking about 1953 is when I started college, so it would have been in 52, 53 when I applied. My draft board, when I turned 18, I had to sign up for the draft, and the draft, the lady at the draft board said, you at the time, you're going to Harvard? I said, yeah. She said, well, where is it in England? I mean, it just wasn't an awareness. So I had those three schools, and I didn't quite know which one to go to, but I was told someone who was three years older than I, was at Harvard, and he'd been a good student at the same high school. I should go meet him, and I did in winter vacation. And he told me about the exciting intellectual life at Harvard, and that appealed to me, and so I said, okay, I'll try Harvard. And my parents were very supportive wherever you wanted to go or wherever you want to do, and you know, sort of assumed that we were going to get an education, a good education,
but very far away.
But very far away. That's correct. I used to go by 45 hours on a train to and from Cambridge, Massachusetts, because the train was much less expensive than going by airplane. I would come home in the winter on an airplane because we didn't have the time. But in September and May, when school ended, I was on a train for 45 hours, coach. But it was a great opportunity to see, both physically to see America, and also to talk to many, many people. About every 300 miles, somebody else would be sitting next to you. And people, if you ask them a few questions, everybody's willing to tell you their life story. So I met a lot of people. I heard their stories. I saw the and I would take different routes. I would go up through New Orleans in the South, or I'd come up through St. Louis, and each time getting a different perspective on America. And that was a very...
learning experience. Wow.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. Although it was tiring. I mean, but you know, you're 18 years old.
You mentioned Kennedy. I recall when he got an honorary degree at Yale, he says, now I have the best of both worlds, a Harvard education and a Yale degree.
Exactly.
okay. So now here's a Texas boy in New England, at Harvard, with presumably a lot of WASPs and white Anglo-Saxon Protestant, and other students from the East. How did you deal with the cultural differences, or were there any?
Oh, there definitely were cultural differences. I tend to get along pretty well with most people, and so that wasn't a problem. I think the difference was between people who'd gone to prep school or even Boston Latin and the education that I'd gotten. I went to a good high school, but it didn't emphasize, we didn't study Latin, so I didn't have a classical education. I hadn't been to art museums and concerts and so forth on the scale that these people, that they, in a way, they were, I saw them as almost, after a while, as jaded. Some of them had seen too much, and for me, everything was
brand new.
Was brand new, and curiosity has always been a characteristic, and so it was just, oh my gosh, this is something. Before I went to college, in Texas, I'd been places. I'd gone to Mexico City a number of times to visit my grandparents and my aunts and uncles and cousins. And when I was 13 years old, I asked my parents, I said, instead of having a party for my bar mitzvah, I'd like to go east. So my father and brother, who was 16 at the time, and I took a train up to Philadelphia, New York, Niagara Falls, Cleveland, Chicago. But that was the only time I'd really been into the East. So the East was quite different, obviously. I mean, they, at the time, when I was 13, they already had television in San Antonio. I think it arrived around that year. I mean, it was, there were a lot of technological differences, and there were cultural differences, and the education that the boys who'd gone to prep school had gotten was quite more intense in a way that was more compatible with what Harvard was expecting of you. I hadn't read the Iliad or the Odyssey, or and they had. And for me, it was all new. And for them, it was already second time around, at least.
Actually,
but I got along. I got along.
It's very similar to my own experience coming from South Bend and going to Brandeis. And
right.
I had not the same background as many of my fellow classmates. And but as a result, I worked hard and they played bridge. So
well, I did, what I did enjoy was the dining room tables. The conversation was filled with people who had strong interests, knowledge, and you could talk about your courses, you could talk about other people's courses, and so there was always a rich exchange of ideas, and that to me has remained a factor in both my memory and also in keeping up with other people. People have ideas that they want to bounce around, and Harvard also had a lot of people that attracted to come and speak there, so you could go to any lectures. I remember being once in a relatively small group with Eleanor Roosevelt, the widow of Franklin Roosevelt, and hearing lectures from Nobel Prize winners and you name it. So there's quite apart from the courses you're taking. So there are people who are coming to these, and there are ideas to be discussed. And also it affected me on my Jewish knowledge. I had a strong emotional connection to Judaism and the Jewish people, but not an intellectual basis. There weren't Jewish day schools or anything comparable to that in those days. So when I got to the Harvard, I started going to the Hillel, and they would bring people who really had a lot of knowledge to convey. And that was very exciting to listen to these presentations on the same level as the courses I was taking in college.
Yeah, so what were some of the highlights of your college career beyond the courses and I guess all the three things you told us about, but not about you as an individual?
Well, for me,
did you do well? What did you major in?
Well, I majored in American history, but I was a pre-med, so I took that were necessary to get apply for medical school, and I applied and was accepted at three medical schools. I didn't become a doctor because I was accepted at Tulane, Washington University in St. Louis, and Stanford, and I was advised and decided to go to Washington University in St. Louis, but I decided the day before I was to start medical school that I really didn't want to be a doctor. That summer, I'd agonized about it, and it also applied to law school, and so my college work was very intense because I had to both do the history, take the general education courses that were required at the time, and other courses of things that I thought I should learn about, and fulfill these science courses. Some came easier than others, or some were more difficult than others, I should say. And so I spent a lot of time studying. I didn't do a lot of extracurricular. Yeah. I would.
And who might have been one of your interesting history teachers? Were there any that stood out?
Yes, there were some. Frederick Merck was one of the senior people there. He perfected his presentation. We had a professor, Tame Taylor, who talked about the Middle Ages, which I knew nothing about. Mm-hmm. And I took a course from Ernest May, who became a well-known historian in diplomatic history of the United States. So I had American history courses, I had other history courses, and I had issues to deal with, like, and a way of dealing with them, like, what were the causes of the Civil War? I remember one of the reading assignments, a book that published under the Amherst imprint, with seven different explanations of why the Civil War came about. You know, was it about slavery? Was it about the Union? Was it this, that, whatever, economic? So that those were all rich courses, rich in ideas. There were a few courses that were duds, but most of them were very challenging intellectually and expanded your range.
What tipped the balance toward law school?
I can only say that in retrospect. I think I ended up becoming a trial lawyer. And I think probably what I liked was being in a situation where there was sort of intellectual combat, because in litigation, when you're in the courtroom, there's always somebody on the other side who's as good or maybe better than you are. And I liked the challenge of that. I didn't know that at the time, but I think maybe that was one of the things that attracted me.
Well, you had been a great speaker. Your speaking awards sort of indicate that you liked.
Yeah, right. I could speak. Right. That was that possibly had. I think the idea was that I knew if I started medical school, I would stay. So the critical decision was, do I start or don't start? And so I decided, I probably, you know, I don't have any regret. Someone asked me recently, do I have any regrets about it? I said, I don't. I think that I probably I did choose the right profession for myself. But, you know, there wasn't any one thing. I mean, I was going to a very fine medical school if I went. But there really was, and I knew a little bit about what it was all about because my brother was a physician by then, and mm-hmm. And he had a career.
But you already had a doctor in the family, so.
Exactly. my mother never said we had to be a doctor or a lawyer. She just said you got to be educated. That was her goal. You got to be educated.
Okay, so now you're on to Harvard Law School.
Correct.
I don't know whether that was a problem getting in there or any other place that you thought.
No, it wasn't, but it wasn't. It was a very different atmosphere than the college. It was not people, I think, who went to Harvard Law School in that era liked the fact that they had gone to Harvard Law School, but most of them didn't love the fact when they were there. But we had some very outstanding people in our class. We had Paul Sarbanes, who became a U.S. Senator in Maryland for umpteen years. We had Antonin Scalia, who was Justice of the U.S. Supreme Court. We had Michael Dukakis, who was a candidate for president in the 1980s, I believe it was, the late 80s. So and a lot of other very, very bright.
1988, yeah.
Right, and a lot of other very bright. But it was just that the atmosphere was a very, it just seemed like it was a different kind of atmosphere. And I suppose some people love it in retrospect, but most people like being a lawyer afterwards and maybe reflecting on the people that they met, but the process itself wasn't something. I don't know what the law school is today as far as students are concerned.
Now, as I understand it, not being someone who went through law school and or became a lawyer, that there's a lot more sort of intellectual activity in law school than there is when you first start practicing law. Was that your
Well, that's experience? Probably true, because when you first start, well, I can't say that, actually, because my second job in the practice of law was as an assistant United States attorney in the District of Columbia. And my responsibility, after I learned what the ropes are, was to make decisions about whether to prosecute or not prosecute for minor, for misdemeanors, for crimes involving less than a year in prison at the time, and to go to the courtroom to try those cases. But when you're in your late 20s, I went to, after law school, I joined the U.S. Coast Guard. I was going to either be drafted or I had an opportunity to become an officer. So I joined the Coast Guard and I became an officer and was stationed on a ship for a while. And then I had many years of reserve duty. But after that, I came to Washington. And the first job that I had, I never got anything delegated to me. It was a two-person office. And I later learned that my predecessor and successor both left for the same reason pretty quickly. But I got into the U.S. Attorney's Office. And when you stand up in your 20, in your late 20s and say, I represent the United States of America, that's a very...
pretty heady stuff.
A heady stuff. And that you have the decision to make, are you going to prosecute this individual, are not going to prosecute this individual and going to change his life. In most cases, it was that person's life. And the decisions aren't easy to make. For example, one episode that I remember vividly, a small episode, a woman comes in and complains that her husband was beating her. So I said, okay, here's a subpoena. We'll get the husband in to hear what his story is. So he comes in a couple of days later and he says, yes. But he says, I came home late. My wife started questioning me where I was. I didn't want to tell her. And I sat down on an easy chair and she started hitting me over the head with a frying pan. And then I beat her. All right, that doesn't excuse his beating her, but that gives some understanding of what motivated him to beat her. Yeah. So do you prosecute him or not prosecute him?
Yeah.
And there were other cases in the course of time where you have very difficult decisions. I once had a case with a man killed two people, but they would have killed him. But he sort of walked into it in a way. And you prosecute him or not prosecute him. I mean, there are a lot of difficult decisions, and you're affecting the lives of a lot of people. As it happens, that person was convicted, the one who killed two people. And a number of years later, I was somewhere, and someone walks up to me and said, do you remember me, Mr. Epstein? I said, no, I don't. He said, well, I was the person you convicted for killing those two people. But he wasn't angry at me. He just, what was so satisfying was he saw that I had been fair in the way I presented the case against him. And this is what happened. So that was one of the
rule of law. Well, he was out by then, I guess.
Well, he was out by then, but he spent a number of years in prison. But the fact that... If you play straight with people, you're honest and try the case fairly, you don't play tricks with them, they understand what your role is. And that was very sobering in a way.
So I didn't know about your Coast Guard experience. How did that emerge, and what were some things about that you recall?
Well, as I said, most of my contemporaries who were not married and so forth were being drafted for service in the Army for 6 months or a year. This was in the early 60s. There was after long after Korea and shortly before Vietnam. So we had a window where the United States was not at war, although some of them had been let go, and then they were mobilized again when the Soviet Union and East Germany put up the Berlin Wall. But there was an opportunity. The Coast Guard wanted to build up its reserve forces, go to officer candidate school for 4 months, where they treat you. It's not like CC in some of these cases. They don't try to treat you like dirt, but it's a very rigid. You've got to have your bed perfectly made. You've got to have your shoes perfectly shined. If you don't, you lose your liberty eventually, and meaning you can't get out on a weekend. So all kinds of things happen. So you learn discipline for sure. But that was an interesting group, and you had some interesting people in your class. And then I was stationed on a ship, and on a ship, the lines between officers and non-officers is very rigid. But some of the officers were a variety of people from various backgrounds. There was one officer who had gone to the Coast Guard Academy. He couldn't say a sentence without curse words. I mean, that was a stream of curse words, everything he talked about. But you meet a variety of people, and you do get contact. And every third day when we were in port, I was responsible for the ship, so to speak. So you get a lot of responsibility. There's 125 people on the ship. But we were stationed.
You were the captain.
That time, yes. But even you know, the captain is the absolute ruler there. And twice I saw him lose his temper, because one time he thought we had lost our way, and another time he thought we'd cut the telephone cables to Manhattan. And he just went berserk. He said, "That's the end of my career. I won't get to be this or that or whatever." I mean, he was out of control, because it turned out we hadn't cut the cables to New York. But that would have been a big event. And captains have all the responsibility and all the power. And for the responsibility, they could pay a big price, even though they were asleep that night when something happened, right? So learning that, and learning how a ship functions, and learning about the hazards of being on a ship, even if it's not at war, and you know, the elements are out there, fires turn up. I was in a gun emplacement, and the firing mechanism didn't go off, and they said, "Well, it could blow up." So you're just standing there, you know, inside this emplacement. You're going to blow up with it. You know, if you run out, you're a coward. You're not doing what you've sworn to do, and that is follow orders. So anyway, so Coast Guard teaches that, and frankly, I think that it's a very good lesson for many people. That they say that during the American Civil War, the fact that soldiers met from different parts of the country helped, in the North at least, make the country into one country rather than a lot of different state loyalties. And I think that's something that's missing in America, is the opportunity for people at different economic levels or education levels to interact with each other. And I think that's what the military provides. And so for me, it was a positive experience, but you know, I wasn't in the war. No one ever shot at me, as far as I know.
Well, the current governor of Maryland, Wes Moore, who has a military background, is very sensitive to that.
And is that right?
Actually interested in a year where kind of a service year for everyone. But anyway, it's a little tricky to implement, but we don't need to go there. But anyway, it's your point is one that many would agree with, and I certainly do, even though I didn't serve in the military. So you had that first job with a small firm.
No, my first job was not with a firm, it was with the government, actually. It was a government agency called the National Capital Planning Commission, which is responsible for the planning of the federal entity. And I had the person I worked for was a very competent lawyer, but he never wanted to delegate anything. I had nothing but time, and I didn't want time. I wanted to learn something. So what I did was I started reading the old, it actually had a very significant impact on my life, because I started reading the minutes of the of the organization, and there'd been a proposal to create a national mausoleum where all of the dead presidents would be reinterred and all future presidents, when they died, would be put in that mausoleum. The proposal came from the Georgia marble manufacturers to build this out of Georgia marble and to cut the history of the United States as a frieze around on the marble mausoleum. But what it did for me was, I said, there must be some president who isn't worthy of being remembered. And I decided that the president was Franklin Pierce. And that had two significant, many different significant moments for me. First of all, it became the basis for my marriage, because when I met my wife at a blind date, so to speak, but on the second date, I asked her, who is America's most obscure president? And she got very excited. I said, why? She said, that's the same question that I asked my dates. And I said, if we have that much in common, we should get married. And 10 weeks later, we got married.
Wow.
And another thing that flowed from that was,
Did she believe it was Pierce?
No, she said it was Chester Arthur. We've never agreed. The other thing that had happened was,
Go ahead.
And the other thing that happened was, I wrote an article about Pierce in the Washington, that appeared in the Washington Post and other places. And then I appeared on one of the late night talk shows, Dick Cavett, to debate with him who was the most obscure American president, Franklin Pierce or Millard Fillmore. That was 51 years ago.
Yeah.
I still have the clip and I still enjoy the clip. And I got to appear on late night television. I got my 2 minutes of fame, another minute probably today. And what was interesting was that they told me, after you finish the interview, you have to leave the stage unless Dick Cavett asks you to stay. Well, he asked me to stay, and the next person on was Mort Saul, the comedian at the time, and they were talking about the cocaine scene. I mean, drugs were, cocaine was, I said, well, I really know nothing about the cocaine scene. And then there was a well-known movie actress, and then there was a man who was defending clubbing baby seals. So I was able to intersperse a few comments here and there along the way with this variety of, from Franklin Pierce and Millard Fillmore to cocaine on the entertainment scene to the I think it was Angela Lansbury, and the final one is the baby seal. So Franklin Pierce has been very good to me, and I even went to his 200th birthday anniversary in New Hampshire, which was about 20 years ago.
So nothing came of the mausoleum.
No, but marriage came out of it. We're 52 years into our marriage, so that was that. I consider that a greater achievement. I don't know, you know, the having all the dead presidents in one place, whether that's a good idea or a bad one.
No, I'm not sure I would go for that either.
And we have all the libraries around.
But you didn't either have the aspiration or the application to any of the New York firms or
New York
private firms.
No, New York to me is the great place to visit kind of thing. Growing up in Texas, going to New York was just too overwhelming, I think. I like Washington D.C. a lot, because I think one of the great things in Washington is the fact that they limit the height of buildings in the District of Columbia. That makes it more manageable. But it's just a nice city, and it has a variety of very interesting people. And obviously, a lot goes on here. So, in every area of activity, the obvious one's political, but in others too.
Yeah. So you went from the National Capital Planning to U.S. Attorney's Office.
Correct.
And then what?
Well, then I went into law.
How long did you stay at? I stayed
for 4 years in the U.S. Attorney's Office. which was sort of considered the general time that you stayed. And I was asked by the U.S. attorney to stay longer, but I said, well, I think it's probably time to move on. And then I practiced private practice with a variety of law firms. And the first law firm that I joined was a firm called Cole and Groner. Each of them were exceptionally good lawyers, both had clerked for Supreme Court justices. Cole had clerked for Robert Jackson, and Groner had clerked for Chief Justice Vinson. And I was there for a number of years. I became a partner there, and then I decided to move on. And then I had a variety of small firm arrangements of my own. And then for a few years, I was in a very large firm out of Ohio. I like being in the courtroom. That's what I love, being in the courtroom, because everything else disappears when you're in the courtroom. You cannot focus on anything else when you're in a trial, and so it's, I like the intensity of it. I like the fact that it's combat without bloodshed. I like the fact that there's going to be a decision made by a jury or a judge within a finite period of time, and that the issues are real. Either it's in criminal cases, it can be liberty, and in civil cases, it can be money. So all of that attracted me a lot, and I enjoyed that part of the career a lot.
Did you specialize in any particular area? Did you specialize in any particular area, or you just whatever went to court?
I guess mostly it was involving businesses. Some involved lawyer conduct. I was involved very much and taught law school also. I sort of touched all the bases of being a lawyer. I taught law school over the years at Georgetown, and I was active in the D.C. bar. I have the distinction or non-distinction of having four times in different decades been nominated for president of the D.C. bar, and I lost each of them, each of the elections. So no one else has ever been nominated that many times. And no one else is, and no one will ever be, because they changed the rules. I don't think they renominate you again. So I like being in the institutional part of the profession. I like being in the educational part of the profession. I like being in the trial part of it. And then I served as an arbitrator, making the decisions in mostly labor management cases, deciding when there's a complaint that the contract is, collective bargaining agreement's been misapplied, or is the termination just, or whatever. So I wanted to understand what's effective advocacy, and being an arbitrator put me in a position of being a judge. I would have liked to have been a federal judge, trial judge, but I don't live with any regrets.
Yeah. So what were some of your more interesting cases that you really think about that you found particularly interesting?
Well, at the time they're happening, they're always interesting. I don't know that, some cases I would represent a group of sales representatives for some of the big companies, and they were, in my view, being mistreated and terminated and so on. And so we had some successes there. I guess the cases that you remember best are the ones that you lose, and those I probably don't want to record. But that's, I think that's true in many things, that what makes you, it's not that you dwell on them, it's just that, and it's not that I could have done anything differently, it's just that, you know, you're so committed to the process that you, and winning is the competitive juice that flows through your veins, so that if you lose a case, you remember it better than the ones you won. But I guess what impressed me, I remember I had a trial that lasted a number of weeks for when I was a prosecutor against someone who had engaged in business fraud. And what impressed me was that afterwards I talked to the jurors after the case had been decided he was convicted. And they remembered details that had happened the first few days. And what was impressive about a jury is that not any one individual is going to remember everything. And not every, and some of them fall asleep maybe in the course of the trial. But when they get together collectively, the 12 jurors, they remember everything collectively. And they take their position very, very seriously. And usually the people, when the case is resolved by the jury, they feel they have really done a public service. Where they get unhappy about their jury service is if the case is settled or dropped in the middle of the trial, then they feel that they haven't realized their obligation. Not that it's any fault of theirs, but it's just that they're frustrated. It's like you're on a ship, you're on an airplane, and we're turning back and we can't go to Europe anymore kind of thing. It's a negative feeling. But I was very impressed, and still am, by the jury system. I think it really worked. I can't say 100% of the time, but even in those cases when I didn't win, I could understand what their thinking was.
So one of the cases, and this leads me into questions about your involvement in Jewish affairs. One of the cases involved, people that were fighting over who really was running a synagogue, but or who had the rights to a synagogue. But tell us about how you got involved in Jewish affairs and Jewish leadership, because I know you became a president of a synagogue.
Right. Well, I moved to Washington the winter of 1961, after I got out of my active duty in the Coast Guard. I still had obligations to go to reserve meetings once a month and 2 weeks every summer, which I did for a number of years. And I moved into a residence in Georgetown, a studio apartment. Later, the building became a senior citizen home. But when I was there, it was not a senior citizen home. I was in my late 20s. And I was wandering around in the neighborhood, and I stumbled on a synagogue there. And I wasn't a regular synagogue goer at the time, but I started going there, and I liked the physical intimacy, and I liked the people that were there. And over the years, the synagogue had a lot of dramatic events happen, and I was involved in some of them, at least trying to solve them. One dramatic event was that the rabbi, who'd been there for 34 years, was murdered. And since I've been in the U.S. Attorney's Office, and the police were contacting different people. I said, well, why don't we channel it through me? And I'll talk to the police, and I know their language. And so I got involved in helping them, although they had a suspect, but they never had enough evidence. They didn't, to try and convince, arrest somebody, you either have to have a confession, an eyewitness, or physical evidence. And they didn't have any of it. DNA didn't exist at the time.
Yeah, David, I lost a little bit here. So let's repeat that part. I'll edit it. But did they ever catch the culprit?
No, they did not. They had a suspect, but as I said, to convict somebody or even to arrest them, you have to have some evidence. You have to have a confession. You have to have an eyewitness or more, or physical evidence. Nowadays, DNA or fingerprints are the physical evidence, but they didn't. DNA testing wasn't around, and there weren't any fingerprints. But they had suspicion based on a few factors. But they never arrested anybody. And so the case remains unresolved and will never be resolved. I became the president eventually, but I was active on the board as a trustee and so forth for many years. And it's a very interesting synagogue because it had sort of several different streams of people coming through. It had It had people who were involved in different levels of government. It was close to the White House, as they put it. And one of the events they had, for example, when the Israeli delegation came for the discussions after Camp David and the Egyptian-Israeli peace treaty. The leaders of Israel at the time, Ezra Weitzman, who was the foreign minister, who was the foreign minister, and Moshe Dayan, who was the defense minister, and both recognizable personalities in Israeli history, they came to the services on Kol Nidre, the evening of Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement, and I just learned recently. Or were you there? Well, I just learned recently that Dayan, who was raised in a very secular family in Israel, he only went to synagogue twice in his life, and this was the second time that he'd been there. And it was written up, and one of the other people who was part of the delegation wrote an autobiography, and he includes the description of being at the synagogue that day. But we had a whole variety of...
Yeah, you had Herman Wouk, I recall.
Well, Herman Wouk, who was the Pulitzer Prize winner for the Caine Mutiny. He served in the Navy, and he wrote Winds of War and War of Remembrance and a number of other books. He was there for many, many years. Joe Lieberman. We had another senator from Nevada, Chick Hecht, who would come there. We had Secretary of Agriculture who came for a while. We have a couple of ambassadors from our congregation, Alfred Moses and Norman Eisen. So that's at that level. But generally, the people, what I like, it's a small space, and I like being in a small space instead of a large auditorium space. This was a small synagogue. The building was built in 1930. The congregation was started in 1910 or 11. And they got to property on the corner in Georgetown. And also in for about the last 30 years, they've had a sort of a continuous flow of people who moved to, young people, men and women who moved to Washington. And if they get married, they have a child that stay in Georgetown, but when they have their second child, they move out to one of the other communities. But for a time there, and still continuing, we had a reputation as being a place where a lot of young men and young women met each other and got married. So yeah. I was once in New York at a Orthodox synagogue, Kehillath Jeshurun, and I was introduced. I was the president, I think, at the time of Kesher. And I was introduced to somebody and said, oh, this David Epstein's the president of Kesher. And the man said, yeah, my daughter was there for two Saturdays and she didn't meet anybody. And he was angry at me in the synagogue. And I said, well, you know, we can't give guarantees. And two Saturdays is a little bit short to have it happen. But the reputation was so that this was sort of a place where young Jewish couples who were interested in Judaism met and married. Well, that's true, but it doesn't always happen quickly. So, yeah.
So, David, I want to turn to, you know, we're getting close to the hour, but we still have a few things. Well, we could talk about many more things, but a couple of the things I wanted to hear about was how you would take your children, each one separately, on a historical visit. Often abroad. Tell us how that got started and some of the places that you visited with your five children.
Right. Well, it got started when my oldest son was 14. And I said, I've got a lot of frequent flyer points and I'd like to travel just the two of us. Because when you have a number of children and you take all of them, what you're generally doing is being a referee, an arbitrator, a dictator, trying to be a dictator. They're fighting or squalling or unhappy. I'm sitting next to the window. You're not. So I said, I wanted one-on-one with my son. And I said, let's go to Italy to study the Roman Empire. And he said at 14, I want to go to the Soviet Union, which was still in existence. This was in 1987. And so the Soviet Union dissolved in 1991. So I said, okay, we're going to visit my father and mother's birthplaces. But first we went to Finland, took a train to Leningrad, as it was then called, later Helsinki. I mean, later St. Petersburg. And there were what was called Jewish refuseniks, people who wanted to leave the country, but the Soviets wouldn't let them. But they were people were, from the outside, were bringing in Jewish religious objects from prayer books and other religious objects. So we did that. We met some refuseniks in there, and then we traveled to Lithuania at my father's birthplace, and also to Bialystok, Poland, the city. My father's birthplace was a town of 10,000 people. 70% of them were Jewish. And my mother's was Bialystok, Poland, which was a city. It had a medical school and so forth. So it was a different cultural atmosphere. But what I, so I, we had it, and the Soviets wouldn't let you travel by yourself. And they still controlled Lithuania at the time. So I asked our guide, who's a young woman, a college student, I said, well, have you ever heard about the Jews in Lithuania? Because the Jews have either left or been murdered during the Holocaust. And she said, yeah, she said, I said, my grandparents said that the herring was better when the Jews were here. So that was her knowledge of the Jews. But we did get to see my father's birthplace town. And what struck me was we were there in August, and it was wet and dank, and the mud was like chocolate pudding. And my father loved Texas, where it's hot. And in the summertime, if it rains, the water is evaporates before it hits the ground. And I said, I could really understand my father's appreciation for Texas just on the weather part of it. Because here we are in August, and it's so. And then we went to my mother's town, and we knocked on the door. And the granddaughter of the person who'd been the landlord, who was not a Jewish family, let us in and treated us very nicely. And we had lunch with her and so on and so forth. She took us to the cemetery where some of my great-grandparents, I think, were buried, although I don't think we could find them. So we had these two experiences, and a lot more. But that was and one other story that I fit in that I like to tell. My father in Texas always had to speak Yiddish to him. It wasn't an issue. We just knew they were speaking Yiddish to him. We spoke to my mother in Yiddish until we became teenagers, and at some point we started talking to her in English. She knew English, she knew Spanish, and so did my father. But my father said, Yiddish will be an important language. Well, I said the evidence of it was many years later when we were on the train on this trip from Warsaw to Berlin. And in my compartment is a married couple. He's a German national from Leipzig, East Germany, and she's a Mongolian by birth. And I'm speaking to them in Yiddish, which is a big chunk of it is Germanic. And they're speaking to me in German. I said, proof that my father was right. Yiddish is very important, because I didn't know German. I do German from Yiddish. Then with my second child, a son, Asher, I took him to Australia. We were there for the second 200th anniversary of the establishment of the British colony, which actually was established there. They sent convicts there originally. Because Georgia was no longer available where they had sent convicts before because of the War of Independence. This was in 1788. And my third child, we finally got to the British, to the Rome. But always, and my fourth child, our daughter, Dina, our third child was Barak. Fourth one was Dina. We went to Turkey and took a big trip around. And I said, we're not going to stay high-class accommodations, but we stayed in the cave in Cappadocia for $7 a night. And then we ended up at a very high class place in Istanbul because somebody were having a business meeting there. They put us up there. But and then the fifth child, we went to South Africa. This was over a period of, I guess, about 15 years or something. But each time the requirement was they had to read something about the history of the place we're going to, and they had to read some piece of literature related to the place. So I put requirements on them. But the idea was that we're going to absorb this trip together as companions, not as where I'm trying to separate people from fighting with each other or whatever it is that children at that age do. So this was so. And what my greatest satisfaction now is that some of my children are now doing the same thing with their own children.
Wow!
So that our oldest son, he took his son to Paris and Berlin, and another one took his son to Barcelona, and another one took his young daughter, his 14-year-old daughter, to Vermont. Just the two of them. But I think that's that I can.
Well,
say
that's
Yeah, what do they say? Copying is sort of the highest form of flattery. So,
right. No, I think it's the opportunity presents itself, and I had at the time I had a lot of frequent flyer points, and so wherever we went, and I tried to make it to places they didn't usually have a demand. The oldest one did want to go to Soviet Union, but the others said, you know, wherever you want to take me, that's fine. So we did a lot of travel on buses and trains and everything else. They were not luxury tours, and they were not resorts. We didn't go to, we may have been at a beach or two, but that wasn't the objective. It was to open, what I've always felt important in teaching children is curiosity. And that's what I hope I transmitted to them.
Well, David, before we sign off, I do want to recognize the fact that your lovely wife, Ellen, has also been a friend for many years and is quite, we could have a conversation with her for an hour as well about her career, knowing almost everybody doing these kinds of interviews. She used to do them herself. About Record and Remember. She has a book called Record and Remember.
Correct.
So, Ellen, we salute you as well. But David, I want to close it out. And we do have a final phrase that we always use to close out our recordings, and it is Sei gesund.
Okay, you learned Yiddish also. Thank you. Thank you very much for inviting me to participate. I enjoyed it.